Well, those have both been very good lead-ins to my talk, because I'm going to be talking about epoxy, but from the point of view of characterizing extrasolar planets. I'm just going to hold it. So I'm going to be talking about the epoch component of the of the epoxy mission, where we used the Deep Impact flyby spacecraft to observe a set of known transiting planets for several weeks at a time in order to characterize them in as much detail as possible. So today I want to first of all introduce transits just for the people here who have never worked with them before. I'll talk about some of the results we got from epoxy, and finally I'll just kind of address the lessons we learned in terms of taking a solar system probe and trying to do this kind of measurement with it. So a transit happens when a planet orbiting another star orbits between us and the star. So if you're measuring the flux from the star, when the planet comes between us and the star, it blocks some of the light, and then when it exits, it goes back up to normal. So for a Jupiter-sized planet around the Sun, this is a 1% dip. So you already know that for your solar system probe, you're going to need pretty high precision photometry. Now, one of the reasons transits are so useful is because you can tell so much just from the shape of the transit. So this is just an example of a differently shaped transit where the planet is further up on the limb and the time it takes to cross to the stellar limb is longer. So from the radius ratio of those of the planet and the star, that's what gives you this depth. So you can, if you know the radius of the star, then you know the radius of the planet. So that gives you the radius of your system, of your planet rather. And if you can use radial velocity measurements, then that gives you a mass. Once you have a radius and a mass, you can get a density. So the second order effect of investigating transits is you start to get some handle on the atmospheric properties. So this blue ring here represents the atmosphere of the planet. As the planet passes in front of the star, the planetary atmosphere spectrum is imprinted on the stellar spectrum. So if you can get a stellar spectrum out here and a stellar spectrum here, then you can disentangle, hopefully, if you have good enough precision, the planetary atmosphere. And this has been used to find molecules in the atmosphere like methane and CO. When the planet goes around behind the star, if you look at the reflection in several wavelengths, you can get an emission spectrum, which I'll talk about a little bit more later. So these are the sorts of things you can do with transits. They're very exciting. You get all of this just from a light curve and some radial velocity measurements, so that's very cool. But they're hard to get. They're informative, but elusive. You need very high precision. This is 1%. That's for Jupiter. If you want to start getting down towards Earth, that's 1% of 1%. So you're talking about, you know, parts per million. You need high phase coverage. This isn't the sort of measurement where you can point at the planet, take a measurement, and go away and analyze it and go, hey, look, we found this, that, or the other. You have to sit on these things. This is hours. This duration here is in hours. And depending on the orbit, can be longer or shorter. So you have to be able to invest the time of your spacecraft to sit on it for a long period of time. And it's also high cadence, except in specific circumstances, you have to kind of sample this very finely. So this ingress and egress here is often on the order of 30 minutes to an hour. So if you want to have this well characterized, you need to have the resources to sit on it and just plug away for hours and hours and hours. So that might be one thing when you're deciding whether to use your spacecraft to do this, to work out if you have that sort of time dedication. One thing that ties all these together that you can do very well is if you go to space. Your phase coverage, you don't have the sun come up during the day, you don't have to wait. You can get reams and reams of successive planetary transits if you're up in space just staring for weeks and weeks at a time. And precision is better from space for the same size. You're going to get more photons because you're not getting distorted by the atmosphere. So that's all very good. Space is where it's at, which is why we're all here today, obviously. So I'm just trying to, I started this slide by just kind of making a guess. Out of all the solar system probes, what are the things you're looking for to try and do this sort of experiment? The caveat is that I'm making all of these assumptions for gas giants, because at the moment, finding Earths and super-Earths, you're talking about very specialized missions like Kepler and MIRF, where they've had to invest a lot of time and money in planning and instrumentation just to find Earths. So for shoehorning existing probes or existing missions into this sort of thing, I think we're probably still in the regime of gas giants, which are very exciting, and we're finding all sorts of interesting things about them. So this is not to say if you shouldn't do it, but just that unless you're really, really, really invested in time and money, it's probably not Earths at the moment. So if you want to get into the transit discovery game with your probe, as I said, you're going to need at least 1% photometric precision and probably stable over time scales of weeks or days. So the shortest transiting planets are on the order of days, but you know, the longer your period, the more interesting you're going to get at this point, because you know, we're really mining the short period planets at the moment, and the game is starting to shift further out. Like, it's going to get more exciting as the periods get longer and longer. So in order to discover transits in a long series light curve, it needs to be stable over long periods of time. So this kind of points more towards heliocentric orbits than Earth orbits, because spacecraft like Hubble and MOST, which are in Earth orbits, you can do this sort of analysis with it, but it's just much more difficult because you're calibrating. They have an orbit of 100 minutes, and these, as I said, these transits are on the order of 100 minutes, so it's hard to disentangle those effects. So you want a spacecraft to be stable over a long period of time. If you're trying to discover transits, you either want a wide field of view with lots of stars, because of the geometry, not every if every star had a planet, they wouldn't all transit anyway. Or you want a narrow field of view, like MIRTH, but in that case, you need to have a very specific subset of stars that you're looking at specifically because you think you're going to have good luck finding planets around them. Like in the case of MIRTH, that's M dwarfs, where a transiting planet has a much larger signature because the star is smaller. As I said before, for the discovery game at least, because you're just sitting and hoping, you're going to need significant dedicated instrument time, and you're going to get a lot of data, so you need to be able to get it down off the spacecraft. So that's for transit discovery. If you are more interested in characterizing transits, you're going to need even better precision if the point is to learn more about the planet from its transit. If you're just observing individual events, then you probably only need to be stable over the timescale of like half a day to a day, more like hours. So that can help you if you don't think that your spacecraft is stable over this sort of timescale. Multiple filters would be great, because then you can do this transmission and emission sort of look, where you look at the transit in different bands and see how the depths change, and that kind of indicates whether molecules are absorbing or emitting in the atmosphere. Here, the field of view constraint is relaxed because you're not trying to discover them. You know which star you're looking at, so you can have a narrow field of view, although it's still good for photometry if it's big enough to have stars of comparable brightness to do relative photometry. In this case, you don't need to have the entire instrument basically dedicated to this, because you have specific times, but those times are set. The planet is going to transit at a certain time, so you need the schedule of your spacecraft to be able to observe it at a certain time. I mean, you probably do. This is not something that I've looked into at all, but especially for microlensing, I'm sure that becomes more important where the spacecraft is relative to Earth. Yeah, for transits, not so much, but microlensing, I think we'll hear more about. Yeah. So here's one mission that we used to try and do this, which was the NASA Epoxy mission, which you've heard a whole bunch about, so I'll just skip to the highlights. The instrument we used was a 30 centimeter in a heliocentric orbit, which we heard about. There's plenty of them, dime a dozen. The limit for us was the onboard memory. There was only 230 megabytes of onboard memory, which meant we could only take 7,000 images. Which meant that every 2 or 3 days we had to turn the spacecraft back to Earth and download the data for a few hours, which reduced our phase coverage because obviously we had to take time away from doing the observations. This is the instrument before launch. This was the high-resolution visible instrument that we used. So we used an optical instrument, and we used the broadest bandpass we could, which was essentially a clear filter, in order to just get as many photons as possible, because our goal was precise light curves. And as Nick said, it's defocused, which you would think like, and when you're trying to look at a comet, which was the original purpose, this is not useful because it's out of focus and you can't see the details. But for us, for high-precision photometry, it's very good because you spread the light over more pixels, which reduces intra-pixel variability, sensitivities in your light curve, and also increases your duty cycle because you can expose for longer before you have to read out the CCD, before it saturates. The science goals... As I said, we were observing a small set of known transiting planets, so 6 in the end that we got good data on. And for each of them, we observed them for several weeks. And there were several things we were trying to do besides get a better handle on the known transiting planet. We were trying to look for additional transiting planets. So if you believe that planets form in a disk and that they're all roughly coplanar. If one of them's transiting, you have a slightly enhanced probability that additional planets will transit if they're in the disk. We're looking for transit timing variations. So if you have a planet in orbit around a star, just a two-body system, then if this is us looking down, then we'll see the transits happening exactly periodically. Just it's a Keplerian orbit, and the transits will happen exactly periodically. If you introduce a third body into the system, then it will have some effect, have some gravitational effect on this one, and the transits will happen cyclically earlier or later, depending on the exact location of this. So if you monitor successive transits for a long period of time, you can start to see this transit timing variation, or theoretically you can start to see this transit timing variation. There haven't actually been any published signals yet. Another thing we were looking for was reflected light. So this is the planet in transit, and what we're looking at is the night side of the planet. So you can't see the reflected part. But as the planet orbits around, the reflected part comes into view. So this is the day side of the planet coming into view. So from us looking down, we can see this reflection. We can see the reflected light coming back. And you can start to look for secondary eclipse signals. So this is an example from Heather Knutson in the infrared. So this is the transit. This is the day side of the planet rotating into view over this half period. And then this is the secondary eclipse here. So this is in the infrared, not exactly the same as what we're trying to do in the optical, but it's a good demonstration, basically, of this phase curve. If the light curves were good enough, we were going to try and look for rings and moons, which have been proposed but haven't ever been confirmed. And finally, obviously, one of the points of the mission was to look at Earth as an exoplanet, which you just heard about. So it was this 8 months here that Dave spoke about, January to August 2008, that we did our observations. So this is just a picture of the orbit. That's the sun, and that's the Earth's orbit, and the white is epoxy. So we're in a heliocentric orbit. And as I said, the stability of the heliocentric orbit is really important for making these long-term, high-precision light curves. You just need it to be as stable as possible. So just some examples of the photometry. This is GJ-436. So this is like 3 weeks of data. So this is the transiting planet that we know already is there. You can see happening every 2.6 days. There was already a pipeline in place for getting photometry, which is great, from the Deep Impact mission. But for our point of view, there was one major problem, which is that the pointing was really bad. So this is an example. This is X position, this is Y position, this is a 128 by 128 subarray on the CCD. This is about a day's worth of data. So this is just with time, so this is the start of the observations, and that's a day later. You can just see that the star wanders out of the field of view, so the scientists just kind of sit there and wait for it to come back. And it comes back and we start doing photometry again, and basically it just wanders around the whole CCD, which when you're trying to do precise photometry, this is not ideal. But I mean, this mission was never meant to do 1% precision photometry.
Is that the cause of the gaps in the light curve up there?
Those gaps are mostly due to that data downlink that I was talking about. So the little gaps are due to this. The big kind of regularish gaps are that download from the spacecraft that we had to do. But yeah, so especially at the start of each planet, of observing each target, there's a lot more missing data because it took us a while to refine the pointing. So we could upload like tweaks to the pointing, but yeah, so by the end we kind of had a better handle on it. But yes, we're trying to do precise photometry, and one thing you should think about when you're like, should I use my space probe to do this, is how stable can you keep it? Can you get all the light hitting one pixel every time? So one of the reasons most has been so successful, the Canadian spacecraft, is like 95% of their flux falls on the same pixel every time, which is great for calibration and great for repeatability, because you're trying to make this light curve. The only variability you want in the light curve is due to the planet, not due to the instrument. So we finally ended up getting up looking like this, but originally, that's what that light curve looked like. Well, that's what about, you know, 3 or 4 hours of that light curve looked like. Oh, no, days. There you go, 3 days of that light curve. So this is 3 or 4%. This is a transit. But all of this is rubbish. And that's due to the fact that, in particular, these ones are due to the fact that the central rows of the CCD are much brighter, are much more sensitive. So when the star crosses those central rows, which it does all the time, you get these brightenings that increase. So we went through various stages of calibration to get it down to this. Finally, this last step to get from here to here, what we do is use the flux itself out of transit. We make this assumption, which may be wrong, and in most cases probably is, that the out of transit data is supposed to be flat. then we use that data to create a map of the CCD to try and correct for the transits. The reason we had to do this is because the only calibration frames that were available were taken on the ground pre-launch, and so many things have happened in the meantime, including that the CCD keeps getting hit by cosmic rays, which if you get a hot cosmic ray hitting your pixels, then occasionally a pixel will lose sensitivity and just never get it back. So the CCD is degrading with time, and the flat fields that were taken before launch are not necessarily applicable anymore, which is why we had to do this kind of shoehorning step of creating this surface that we could use to correct the data. So this is a nice progression here. This is 2 years of work of me and a grad student to make that. So here's just some examples of some of the targets we looked at. It's HAT-P4, TRES-2. This one's interesting, TRES-3. We think this is spot modulation of the star, like the star had a star spot on it that rotated into view over the course of the observations. Here's our family portrait. So these are the 6 planets that we observed that we got good data on. There was an extra one that we just left off because we never got good data on it. And these are the refined system parameters that we developed, that we derived in each case. In several cases, this is the first time that they've been followed up in extensive detail. So in some cases, the numbers got much better than the previously existing ones. This is all to scale too, so these phases are all the same and these relative fluxes are all the same. So you can see GJ-436, which is a Neptune-sized planet around an M-dwarf, you can see how much smaller it is and how much shorter it is compared to the rest. So these are all more like gas giants around solar-type stars. So for TRES-2 and TRES-3, which are the ones which we get the best times for just because there's so much ingress and egress, it's like 20 to 30 seconds. Then for HAT-4 and WASP-3, these ones where it's more broad, it was more like 40 seconds to a minute. So a lot of that was due to the fact that we had to do this ad hoc out of transit flattening, which we obviously can't use the in-transit data to use it to do the flattening because there's obviously changes then. So we exclude that data, which means that the transit data is the least well-calibrated data in the data set, of course. So just to summarize some of the results, GJ-436, Sarah Ballard has a paper in press that you can find on AstroPH if you want. GJ-436, there was some evidence previously in the literature that was perhaps an extra planet in that system. So we observed the system for 3 weeks, as you saw. We never saw any evidence of an additional transiting planet. And by doing a Monte Carlo simulation of injecting transits into the light curve and seeing what we could recover, we established that with 95% confidence, we could rule out things greater than 1.25 size of the Earth interior to GJ-436. And out to a period of 8.5 days, if it was exactly 90 degrees inclination, we would have seen something greater than 2 Earth radii, which is like super Earth sort of range now. For HAT-P7, I have a paper out where HAT-P7 was a particularly good target for the reflected light that I was talking about earlier because it's so close to its parent star and its parent star is quite large. So we ended up not actually detecting a secondary eclipse, but we could put an upper limit on the secondary eclipse, which agreed with the measurement that Kepler eventually published when I was writing my paper. Finally, there's another paper that I've submitted, which I'm just going to get to the referee report on at some stage, for the last 4 targets, which is going to present the refined system parameters and sets of transit times. Lessons learned. So you want to take your solar system probe and go out and look at transiting planets. Can't stress this enough. You really want it to be as repeatable as possible, this measurement. If you can make everything as stable as possible, you're so far ahead in the game. A lot of the times people say with these expensive spacecraft, what you're building is the world's most expensive thermometer. So any thermal changes in the spacecraft will almost always creep into your photometry somehow. They'll change the focal plane, they'll change the electronics readout, something will happen, there'll be some second order effect. And it's obviously preferable if you can keep the star in the field of view. That's good. Calibration. If you have in situ calibration where you can calibrate your images as you go, again, this is just going to give you such a leap ahead and you'll be able to do so much better. What this is one of these surfaces that we fit to the data. So this is the 128 by 128 subarray in the middle, and it just the spline fitting program just extrapolates outwards from there. So just concentrate on this area. This basically represents the difference between the flat fields taken before launch and now. So you can see like whole quadrants of the CCD have changed. You can see like maybe a dust speck or something in the middle has appeared. So you really want to be able to calibrate your data as you go.
Did you, for these different targets, you have different calibrations?
Yes, because we also found it was color dependent. These surfaces were color. We tried a couple of times. It seemed the observations were taken over 8 months, and it seemed like the CCD was actually changing on that timescale as well. So like the observations that we took at the start for HAT-P4, we actually went back and got more observations for HAT-P4 later, and we couldn't use the initial HAT-P4 data to calibrate the latter HAT-P4 data, which was like 6 months later. There's just enough change and drift in the meantime that this surface here changes. So that was kind of awkward. There is definitely a color dependence. So the only sorts of calibration fields we had were created with a green LED next to the CCD, and they just weren't sufficient.
Yeah, I missed the part where you said what the variations are in this.
So this is our kind of constructed flat field where we take the out-of-transit data and use it to map the CCD. So this is basically just relative sensitivity of the pixels. So this is the 128 by 128 subarray in the middle. This is where you should concentrate. And it's actually four CCDs to mosaic, which is why you have these, like, that's a darker one, this is a brighter one, darker one, brighter one. And these are these rows.
How big are the fluctuations?
These are about 1%. Well, so the row one was like that first feature that I showed is like 3 or 4%, but we can take that out pretty, oops, right there. Ah, there we go. So this is like 3 or 4%. So that's huge. These are the sorts of fluctuations that are left, which are kind of 0.5 to 1%. So those are the ones that have been taken out by that surface. Well, I mean, there just wasn't any facility on board to do flat fields, and yeah, I mean, we thought about things like looking at a really bright star that would just like flood the field of view or something. But one of the things that I'll get to with lessons learned is that it's just, I mean, especially with space, it's just so expensive to change anything. So one of the reasons we got to do this mission was because we did it on the Jeep. Like, everything was set at the start. We got a 50-second exposure time. That was what set our magnitude limit for looking at stars. We got told, like, how many times we could change the pointing and stuff because it was all budgeted down to the last cent. So when we started talking about making additional changes, they were kind of like, don't have the money. It's still going. Epoxy's still up there. It's kind of just in hibernation at the moment while it waits for... I think it's actually trying a few other things, but it's basically waiting for the next comet encounter. So these are all things where we should learn the lesson, and next time we should go back with a plan and be like, yes, we'll do it, but one of the things we need to include is calibration that happens every week or something. So that's what you definitely want to include this somewhere.
Interesting math. So you basically derive this by deconvolving that big messy point spread function as it was wandering at random across the surface here?
Well, so what we...
Seconds.
Oh, so this is 128 by 128. That 4 arc seconds was 10 pixels.
Okay.
So, like a tenth of that. Yeah, that... Yeah, that's right. So basically what we did was we used a random subset of the out-of-transit points and we found a robust mean of the nearest spatial neighbors to that, where we excluded them if they were close in time. So we want, like, if you're trying to calibrate this point here, you want all the points that are nearby in space but not in time, because if there was some stellar event that happened, you don't want to calibrate that out. So then you just basically create a 2D spline of the surface using that subset of random points from your light curve where you've done this robust average. I mean, it kind of ended up being a bit ad hoc at the end, but like we got stuck.
And this was all with that wide band, not single colors.
This is all just with that wide band. So our goal here, we weren't trying to do multicolor stuff. We were just trying to get as many photons as possible to get this light curve. So we got stuck here for a long time, just trying to work out what the next step was to calibrate this out, until we finally just said, look, we need to at least look at the transits if we can't do additional transits or that kind of stuff.
I was asking for a very vulnerable problem. I mean, very impressive about that.
Well, it was 2 years, and we got there in the end, but it was a lot of work. So that's going to be my last slide. So photons, where possible, I mean, when you're choosing your instrument to do this with, try to make sure that you've chosen a set of stars that matches your instrument quite well. So for us, it turns out our CCD was quite red sensitive. So GJ436 is our best light curve by far because it's an M dwarf, so it's quite red. So if you can do that in advance, if you can do that vetting in advance, pick stars that are a good match for your instrument to get as many photons through as possible. Consider like the throughput of your instrument. Where are you going to maximize your return? Then you can use that to select your stars. And it sounds obvious when I say yes, you need lots of photons to do precise work. But when you're trying to do this, you know, make a mission do something it wasn't supposed to do, it's definitely something that you need to think about. Because epoxy was never meant, the deep impact spacecraft was never meant to do stable time series photometry for weeks at a time. But we managed to do it. But because we were careful about what we did. And finally, in space, especially, time is lots of money. So you need to be able to correct things on the fly. And when you're setting up your project, you need to make sure that there are resources in place that if something happens, you can fix it within a day or two. Because a week lost in space is such a loss. It's a big loss. So just when you're allocating resources, think about things that could go wrong and that you need people in place. So finally, it is possible to do this. You can take a solar system probe and use it to observe transits of extrasolar planets. It's just going to require a lot of careful thought about, you know, whether your instrument is appropriate, whether your subset of stars is appropriate, and when you get the data, you know, you might need to do a little bit of finessing. But I don't want to leave it on a negative note. You know, with time and effort, you can access this parameter space of long phase coverage, of high precision, of high cadence from space, if you try. And good luck to you if you try. So that's what I have. Thank you very much. I'm just going to show GJ436 again because it's our prettiest one. Oh, there we go. So I think it was, you know, 0.5 millimags point to point at the end, and then if you integrated over the transit, it was more like 0.1. So we were getting down to, I don't have the slide here, but you can see what an Earth-sized transit would have looked like, and we would have seen it if it was on such a short period as GJ436b.
So you mentioned you don't have any published time.
Well, we don't. Epoxy doesn't. In the ether somewhere, there are probably transit timing variations that are due to be published.
So it seems that in hindsight, one thing that would have been relatively simple that had been done before launch would have been to have some sort of lossless compression, like a G-zip option. Right?
Right.
Because like transiting planets is like, there's like nothing to be really black, and then there's this really bright thing in the middle.
Yeah.
Which you think would be like trivial to compress, and then you wouldn't have to be separated, you wouldn't have to star drifting on the field, I mean, it would have solved a lot of problems.
Yeah.
But apparently it's really expensive to install the new software once the thing's up in space.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, you have to work with what you've got.
The lossless compression and the stuff that doesn't compress is anymore. So I don't think
I was thinking, like, just for each frame. Like not averaging the time. But...
Well, I mean, just the compression scheme, the thing that you can't compress is more.
Right.
So,
you mean the background noise?
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, the way you get rid of it is with lossy compression. You can throw away at least a significant bit of the square root compression scheme. You can sort of throw away at least a significant bit.
Right. But I think if you're looking at like really bright objects like that, I mean, I think you're dominated by this photon counting from the star, not background spectrum.
Yeah. Well, again, I mean, it was designed to look at a honking great comet, right, which took up a significant fraction of the field of view. But that's something you can think about when you were setting up your project, the data download capacity of your instrument and the network, basically. If you have to turn around every half an hour and spend half an hour downloading data, then it's not going to work as well. Any more questions?
In the post-Kepler era, what's the opportunity space for things
bright stars? Yeah, because Kepler's faint targets, and the point is that you can't follow them up very well. Like, if we find an Earth-sized planet around a 13th magnitude star, radial velocities are going to be really hard-pressed to do anything without it. But if you can look at a known transiting planet system and find an Earth-sized transit, like GJ436 is 10th magnitude, we'd be able to do that. But yeah, most of the Kepler targets that come out are going to be too faint for the sorts of, like, you know, atmospheric studies in the transmission spectrum, the emission spectrum. That's all at the moment happening around 8th and 9th magnitude stars. That's not going to happen around 13th magnitude stars. And when JWST comes on board, we're going to need bright targets. So it's still important that we look around bright targets for stars. We need them, for planets rather. Some of the... Oh, right. That's right. So we have an upper limit on the secondary eclipse, which for TRES 2, I think... I always get TRES 2 and TRES 3 mixed up because I dealt with them at the same time. I think for TRES 2, it was not necessarily a meaningful upper limit. Like, it didn't really tell us anything. For TRES 3, I think we could say the albedo had to be less than 0.6. But for TRES 2, you know, we didn't rule out any physical parameter space. The transit timing showed no... So TRES 2 actually was one of the ones where there was a possible prediction of long-term changes in the transit parameters. We weakened those trends. We didn't see any strengthening of those trends. So that's all going to go on AstroPH soon. So the TRES 3, it was about 30 seconds, the order of time and accuracy for these. That's right. One of the reasons I got the HAPPY 7, I was trying to get the HAPPY 7 paper out as fast as possible because I knew that it was in the Kepler field as well. And for HAPPY 7, again, we could put a sort of meaningful upper limit in the secondary eclipse. Unfortunately, for TRES 2, we couldn't end up because it's just not as good a target as HAPPY 7 for putting limits. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.